In the first place, our records concerning the Greek doctrines are frightfully incomplete. We have no full understanding of their extremely complex system. A parallel to this, or parallels to this, will be found in the early Aryan Indic and also in the Egyptian. We know, for instance, that most of the deities of the Vedas have not been clearly defined. It is true that we have a central stem of theological structure, like a tree, upon which the principal gods and their shaktis and their aspects have been noted. But they are surrounded by an infinite group of deities and demigods and godlings that even the native philosopher knows very little about. They have come down from most remote times, and their meanings, unless clearly indicated by their name structures, are most difficult to determine. Even worse is our situation with the Egyptian. Lacking an adequate literature and depending almost entirely upon the Greek or Roman period, in which the ancient religion had already fallen into decline, the majority of Egyptian deities are not understandable. We know that they had meaning, and probably very important meaning, but the grand scheme or pattern by which they could be fitted together is as yet lacking. And to a large measure, this is true of the Greek. We have explained to you before that in our Greek system, we also have a series of interrelated secondary systems. Greek mythology is not from one source, nor does it express the unfolding conviction of one culture group. It is a commixture, and we know definitely that the Greeks borrowed from the Egyptians at an early date. We know also that they had some knowledge of the East Indian divinities and were affected by the Chaldean and Persian theologies. Thus, it is questionable if all of this structure was understandable even to the average Greek who was informed in such matters. The mysteries, as celebrated, the great state institutions of religion, may have helped, but could not and did not apparently completely unfold the system. Perhaps it was done on purpose. Perhaps a large part of this labor was left to the inquiry of the truth seeker, who was thereby stirred and stimulated, as in strange hieroglyphical symbols, to seek a meaning or to draw from his own consciousness the solution to the riddle. In any event, we are at a disadvantage, and this disadvantage has been made worse by the general neglect of the field and by this powerful antagonism against it in the early rise of the church. Every effort was made to destroy the old monuments and records, and such as survived have been long and traditionally associated with false interpretations, which are difficult to overcome after so long a period. In the closing lecture of this series, we will go into the Neoplatonic restoration of the mysteries as far as the first four centuries of the Christian era were able to cope with the subject. We gain help from Plato and from other writers, but they did not unfold the problem systematically. What we learn is good, helpful, and may be a key to further research, but they did not give us all the answers, nor did they fit the pattern together into a complete and orderly sequence. Thus we have traces of system. We have bridges between the Greek, the Chaldean, and the Indic, the Egyptian, and the Persian, but these bridges are not always clear, and there are many breaks in one case in one of the religions and in another case in another of the religions, so that we are not able to fit these together to form the grand and simple pattern that we would like to be able to unfold in a good classroom manner. The information is simply lacking, and to attempt to overlook this lacking would merely to be to invent, which I do not think we are justified in doing. We are going to try merely to explain as far as we can that which is known. We have every reason to recognize that the Greeks, in their philosophical era, were beginning to use what came later in medieval thinking to be called the macrocosm-microcosm theory. In other words, they had begun to sense that the universe was the great being and man was the little universe. They had begun to create parallels between the unfolding life of the universe and the unfolding nature of man. They had further come to the conclusion that the structure of man was a miniature of the greater world, and that the universal principles existing in space had a peculiar and natural existence in man. Therefore, that man could be a clue to the universal mystery, even as the universal mystery in its total comprehension must be the total answer to the mystery of man. Thus, the macrocosm-microcosm concept led definitely to the motion of mythology toward psychology, toward the recognition that the deities existed as principles, energies, powers, and forces operating within the consciousness of man himself. They have given us considerable material in this direction, but again, the patterns are not unbroken. And in an effort to put together what we can of these patterns, we must attempt in a way to restore the old concept of the universe. The universe as it was recognized not only by ancient man in the European and Near Eastern theaters, but for that purpose, the total life of the ancient races. For this grand pattern permeates all of them, descending to its last great exponent in our thinking, and that was Paracelsus of Hohenheim, who attempted to restore this entire theory and to use it as the basis of therapy. He again, however, wrote in such abominable low German that most of his ideas are obscure to us. And so tedious is the problem of reading him that only the most heroic thinker will attempt to mine this source of information at the present time. All these are detriments, but even in spite of the detriments, we have certain rather obvious strong points upon which we can build. We have mentioned that the primary deities of the Greeks consisted of a duality of powers, of which Uranus, or heaven, and Gaia, or earth, were perhaps the most primary. Uranus, or heaven, represents pure life, pure existence, the absolutely unconditioned state of energy. The earth, or the Great Mother, represents the utter and complete polarity of matter. Now, the Greeks were aware that both spirit and matter were the offspring of eternity, that they were enclosed within or held in a complete abstraction, even more remote from our understanding than the primary division, that this complete abstraction was also the common ground in which spirit and matter had an identity. Thus, the Greeks were aware of the fact that spirit and matter are not separate principles. They are merely the polarizations of an absolute or unconditioned essence. Thus, pure life and pure matter are themselves polarities of each other, with matter as the least degree of manifested life, and life as the supreme condition of the material state. These drift or move slowly, like the harmonic intervals of a musical string, such as the monochord. And each of these conditions is finally a part or a degree or a state of absolute existence. Naturally, as with other peoples, efforts to define the nature of this absolute were considered more or less fruitless. Socrates, Pythagoras, Buddha, Confucius, and Plato agreed primarily in the principle that to define the infinite is to defile the infinite. These things are simply beyond comprehension. But out of the utterly incomprehensible, there emerges not only these conceivable or hypothetical polarities upon which all existence rests, but by their polarization, an interval is created. An interval between the above and the below. An interval between extremes. And in this common ground, or in this what the Nordic peoples call the Nunga gap, or the cleft in space, creation as we know it comes into existence. And out of the absolute operations of spirit and matter, or complete life and complete material substance, as these were understood, there arose a product which was the result of the operation of one on the other. And this product was time. Time was therefore the most ancient child of heaven and earth. And the experience of time has to do with duration. And as the Greeks express it, time is the measure of separateness. In other words, only when reality is in some way reduced from its own nature into a semi-illusionary state, or relativity takes the place of absolutivity. Only under such conditions can time come into existence. For time is a kind of a measure of the separateness of something from allness. While it remains within allness, it is not subject to time. But when it is separate from allness, it is subject to coming into existence. It is subject to continuing in existence. And it is subject to dissolution or departure from existence. And time is the measure of the coming, the continuing, and the departing of all things. Time, therefore, is merely man's way, or man and nature's means of distinguishing the difference between the finite and the infinite. That which is infinite is timeless. That which is finite has an impermanent relationship to the infinite. And that impermanent relationship is time. And this time factor is that devouring thing which in turn dissolves and absorbs everything over which it is placed as ruler or governor. So between these two abstractions arises the dim, mysterious form of Cronus, the deity holding in one hand the sickle, the one that cuts all things down. This comes back to us in our medieval thinking as Father Time with his scythe, who cuts down all creatures. He is the reaper, the gatherer upper of things. And in the ancient symbols, he carries not only the scythe in his hand, but wears a crown composed of an hourglass. This is very interesting. And in one group of symbols, he is represented as combing out the tresses of a beautiful maiden, as though gradually combing out, or separating, or removing the snarls, or the knots, or the cords, or the twists, or the turnings and confusions of everything. Because in the end, time alone combs out all confusion. and becomes the absolute critic, the final censor, the absolute judge of everything that exists. For that which is the noblest, as the Greeks pointed out, has the greatest endurance in time. The truly great person is longest remembered. The great truth is longest honored. And that which is less is more quickly forgotten or lost in the reaping of time. Thus many powerful and splendid things vanish in time because of their deficiency in reality. Whereas those things most like reality or possessing the greatest participation in reality have the greatest endurance in time. Time, though it must reap everything, protects some things longer than others and operates more slowly on those things over which it has less authority because they have more of timelessness or reality in themselves. So we have this ancient background, but it is a very highly theoretical background. It is almost as though Uranus and Gaia and Cronus represent a living stage. They are like a vast theater of living energies upon which the drama will be unfolded. You do not see them anymore in the play because they are both the stage and the whole of the play. We no longer see them as persons, but they in some way mysteriously divide the play. For because of them, the play has its beginning, its middle, and its end. Because of them, the play has its chronology, its sequences. And it portrays those things which belong under the powers of heaven, earth, and time. Thus we see the effect of these elements constituting the legitimate factors of drama, as is represented in the plays of Sophocles and the other great Greek playwrights. So the playwrights wrote only because time created drama. And without the time quality intervals, there would be no drama. Your great cavalcade play, showing the life of a person, is the unfolding of time in that person. Or if a series of abrupt events make a complete play to be written as though the acting was within a few hours, this in turn is another kind of time pattern that determines the plot and is present forever, although not noticeable. Creation, therefore, is played upon the theater of time, upon the stage of this strange drama. The scenery, all of the mysterious parts of the amphitheater into which the audience gather to behold the play. This vast auditorium or Colosseum or whatever it may be is actually the interval or the great space between spirit and matter in which the drama of time ceaselessly and inevitably unfolds. So the Greeks, having set their great stage, then produce their cast of characters, characters who are going to play out the drama, who are going to become the personifications of heaven, earth, and time. Everything must be so triangulated, and without this triangulation, there can be no drama. For every drama, they say, is a triangle of some kind. We have one we know very well in modern drama called the Hollywood Triangle, which has probably supplied the incentive for 90% of our motion pictures. It is rather simple, homely, and destructive, but we make constant use of it. Now, we then see also another division. All of this great background is made up of things that as such we cannot touch or feel or know. They therefore belong together to a kind of an imponderable. They are too remote, too mysterious for us even to picture them adequately. We cannot make diagrams of them successfully. They more or less lurk together on the blank paper upon which other pictures will be drawn. They become dimensions, laws and rules, never seen of themselves, but never absent from any compound that exists. Out of this then arises, as we have said, the being who, to the Greek mind, became the focal point, or the manifestation of things unmanifested. And this being was Zeus. Zeus being the surviving child of time. In other words, the child that time could not and did not dissolve. And this brings us to the nature of Zeus per se. Now in this struggle between absolute life, absolute extent of matter, and the rule or the law moving among them, time, there was produced something which was the product now not of heaven and earth alone, but of heaven, earth, and time together operating. Now, if we have spirit and we have matter and we have time, and now we call this cause, effect, and we place between cause and effect another term meaning time, and this is opportunity. So we have cause, effect, and the opportunity or condition of experiencing them. We have spirit and matter, and we have experience. We have the mysterious power of time that becomes, so to say, the womb of the emergence of something. And this thing that emerges is, according to the Greek concept, an overbeing, a tremendous but not completely intangible creature. This creature, therefore, to them signified what to the Hindus we call the principle of Para-Atman. This being was a first, a beginning of things. It had certain attributes, and these attributes we like to think of sometimes in our concept of consciousness. Buddha said that there is no such a thing as consciousness except that which results from the reaction of cause and effect. Cause and effect produces consciousness. Therefore, eternal cause and eternal effect, spirit and matter, through duration or the unfolding of things in an orderly sequence, produce together what we call consciousness. Now this is root consciousness. This is not the kind of consciousness that says, I know, nor is it the kind of consciousness that says, I think, or I believe, or I observe. Because assuming that this consciousness arose in the mystery of space and matter, we know that space is invisible, pure matter is invisible, time is invisible. So none of this condition arose from the contemplation of externals. It arose from the interior experience of certain flashing awareness, or the discovery and the development of what the Greeks call the ox-eyed god, the mysterious god whose seeing is of an internal nature, like the ancient concept of Amitabha in Tibet, the contemplating Dhyana Buddha, that internalizes to know and externalizes to lose knowledge. This is a peculiar concept, but it is common to most people. So Zeus blazes forth as being the intuitive factor of the realization of the action of life and matter through time. Thus Zeus becomes, in a sense, the wisest of all gods, because he possesses the law of wisdom and endures in time. On the other hand, Zeus is strangely detached from all things that may be regarded as knowledge by man. Zeus represents, therefore, the flash of total awareness, apart from the process of knowing. In the Tibetan and the Hindu, we discover that thought is created before mind. Now this would be a bit of a stopper, as they used to say in England, but it is nevertheless true. And Zeus is the eternal thinker, thinking the non-eternal thought which is existence. Zeus, therefore, is the thinker who produces within itself a strange and mysterious power. Perhaps we would be better almost to say that Zeus is thought, as yet unembodied in a thinker. The thought by means of which, in its infinite ramification, a mind becomes necessary, but which in its own nature we do not recognize as necessary. Thus we have in Zeus a very strange basic value. And in the study or analogy between the Greek system of the universe and their microcosmic system, or the relationship to man, Zeus represented the total auric or magnetic field of man. He was this sphere of energy from which the body of man is derived, and which is the true abode of man, who dwells not in the body, but in the field of energy behind the body. Zeus, therefore, is an interesting deity, and we begin to understand now some of the things that he does. Most of the Greek gods are biphenomenal. That is, they have two aspects, or two appearances, by which we know them. Zeus is not. Zeus, however, has another attribute. He is polyphenomenal. Instead of taking on, for instance, another god of the Greeks that we can mention would be Hermes or Mercury. We know Hermes among the Greek arts mostly as a young man with winged heels and a winged hat, carrying a caduceus or staff and springing off into space, apparently, in the best architecture of such sculptors as Cellini. But this is not actually the only form. The old Greeks made the statue as that of a venerable old bearded man, robed in a heavy toga and leaning upon a staff, sometimes bound with a serpent and sometimes not. Thus there was what was called the old or aged Hermes and the young one. And the same is true of Dionysus, who is represented as an old bearded man or as a very effeminate youth with a garland of vine leaves in his hair. There were two distinct forms of each of these deities. In Zeus there is not. But Zeus has this other peculiarity of forever taking on other shapes. He takes on the form of the swan in the story of Leda. He takes on the form of the bull and abducts Europa. He is constantly taking on forms, but none of these forms are his own. And when whatever the escapade is that he is at present engaged upon, he returns to his own shape. Now, most of your deities in ancient times had this power to change their forms at will. The moment you represent or recognize Zeus as thought, or as a being, a principle, we then become aware that this principle is moving constantly through an infinite pageantry of forms and appearances. Therefore, that it should appear in countless forms is not unreasonable. especially if, as in the Greek mythology, all of the forms of Zeus are veiled references to the zodiacal forms, as in the Europa, which is the bull Taurus. This different type of changing appearances merely represents the power of this universal agent or principle, which in the course of existence takes upon itself all forms. In some of the Oriental legends, we are told that the Supreme Being always took upon itself male and female aspects in the generation of any kind of creation. Thus, the great deity Brahma, becoming the male and female creature, as in the case, for instance, of the horse and the mare, took upon himself these forms and generated these creatures that then endured forever. But this one life has to take upon itself the positive and negative aspect of every type of creature that it is going to generate. Otherwise, it cannot generate them. And this is one of the principles that lies behind the Greek mythology, which makes it much more interesting when you begin to study the principles involved. The Greeks also recognize that in their order of gods, they had something that must correspond to the various segments of human consciousness. And the Greeks had an order of worlds. These worlds were in every case related to their mystery dramas and to their ancient concepts of astronomy and to the elements which they recognized and in which they followed very closely most other peoples, who represented or recognized four elements and a fifth essence or principle called in alchemy the quintessence or the fifth power, from the very word quintessence, which means fifth essence. In the Greek system, then, we start with a descent of gods. And these gods descending become embodied in terms which are not so different from those of some of the Asiatic philosophies, and we'll try to work out something with them. The first of all is the celestial world. Now, by the celestial world is meant primarily the world of the celestial bodies, known as the Empyrean, or the highest abode, the abode of the luminous beings or star gods that lie at the root of things. This world was ruled over by Apollo, who was more or less the custodian and who rode his chariot through this diffusion as the Lord of the Sun. But the very world, star-spangled and planet-embroidered, through which he moved, was itself the vestment or the flowing robe of the great Hierophant. And whenever the initiate, as Apuleius tells us, in the mysteries of Persephone, passed into the chamber of initiation, he was invested in a garment which seemed to be of one piece and very full, which was slipped over his head and hung down around him on all sides. And on this garment were placed the representations of all of the heavenly and sidereal bodies, so that he was heaven vestured when he went in to the great mysteries. This celestial region is the atmic plane of Asia, of Asiatic thinking. And this plane is substantially and essentially the manifestation of Zeus. But it is placed under the control and direction of one of the sons of Zeus. For this son, Helios, or light, then emerges from the dark mystery to bear witness to the hidden father, who is robed in the vestments of the great mystery, which is star-spangled space. these elements we have to realize. Now, in this mystery in which, as yet, Zeus has not moved into objectivity, we find two orders of deities developing, as we mentioned. One derived from the ancient Titanic orders, the old gods, and the others arising from the progeny of or children of Zeus himself. And ultimately, as in most other mythologies, the old gods retire, disappear, and cease to be present. And the children of Zeus, or the products of this order of creation, take over and become the custodians of the various planes involved. The next world below the so-called celestial is called the spiritual. Now, there is a difference between the spiritual and the celestial. The celestial has to do with dimensions that are beyond. The spiritual life of man, for example, may be expressed through conduct here in this world. An individual may be a spiritual person without being a celestial being. He may have virtues and values. He may be heaven-like in some parts of his nature, but not so totally so that he can immediately retire into a heavenly condition. Spiritual, therefore, to the Greeks, had a little different quality of meaning from what we understand. To them, it would be more, we will say, inspirational, intuitional. It was a region or area of insight by an over faculty or an internal apperception of reality. And this would correspond to the Indian concept of buddhi. And we will gradually come into the great triad of Indian philosophy, Atma, Buddhi, and Manas. Atma being, to a degree then, the celestial, buddhi the spiritual, Manas the mental. Now, these conditions differ. Buddha is said, Gautama Buddha, is said to have experienced identity with buddhi, or with the principle of pure, intuitive, or illuminated intuition, or identification with the power to apperceive reality. This is supposedly also the idea of the samadhi, which is a spiritual state, but it exists within a celestial universe superior to itself. Now, in the Greek mythology, we might be surprised to try to figure out to whom this would be associated in our quick list of the deities, and we probably would not hit the correct one. But this association was made with Hera, the wife of Zeus, known to the Romans as Juno. Now, in the actual story of the Greek mythology, Hera shares with Zeus in the rulership of the world. Hera is referred to as the goddess governing and protecting the moral life of the world. She is the one with whom Zeus is continually having difficulties whenever he performs any action by means of which he projects a formal creation into existence. His infidelity to her causes constantly her retaliation. And it is the retaliation of the buddhic intuition against the motions and processes of universal mind that constitutes quite an involved drama on this stage of affairs. We are reminded of the words of Paul that he tells us, when he would do good, evil is ever nigh unto him. The conflict between man's intuitive sense of realities and the eternal demands upon him by the processes of creation are represented by the struggle between Zeus and Hera, or Jupiter and Juno. And yet she is the queen of heaven, She is the ruler of the spiritual region because she represents pure Buddhic intuition. She represents this same factor that has been associated with the female since the beginning of time, the immediate apperception of value without intellection. And therefore, she must always, as the Buddhic principle, be the one who knows without knowing how she knows, or the one who knows without reason, arriving instantly at conclusions to which reason may attain only after the most circuitous efforts. And this peculiar internal inspirational intuition is therefore keyed to this spiritual region over which Hera has dominion. And we will later see how this drama works out. But we have to sort of get the members of the cast identified. Now the third of these principles is the mental or intellectual sphere, the Indian monastic world, divided into an old and a new, a high and a low, and therefore under the control of the deity that has no nature of its own, but takes on whatever nature that comes to it because of employment. In other words, we are speaking now of Hermes. Hermes representing the messenger or the communicator of the divine power. Hermes serves all the gods and becomes identified immediately with the one he serves. Having completed the service, he is no longer so identified. He brings no message of his own. He is only the communicator. And he is represented by the old bearded man and the young man with the wings on his feet. And the higher mind, the Arupa Manas, is represented by the old bearded man. And the lower mind, or the embodied Manas, is represented by the young man. Therefore, there are two minds in man, the abstract or reasoning mind and the concrete or thinking mind. And thought and reason are not the same, but they are both interpreters, messengers. And like these messengers, they have several attributes. For Mercury, Hermes, is not only the one who becomes the guide, the Virgil to every Dante seeking to pass through the mysteries of the under region, but also this deity is the god of thieves, of those who steal, of lying, of misrepresentation, and he is represented in his younger form nearly always as carrying with his caduceus a purse. He is the god of accumulation. And one of the main negative functions of the lower mind is accumulation. In other words, the use of intellect to increase worldly goods or possessions. Whereas the old Hermes with the beard and leaning upon his ancient staff is like Guillemons, the aged guardian of the Grail Castle, or Merlin, the wise man. This is the mind that has gone beyond, and therefore has chosen the philosophic contemplation of reality. So the twofold phases of mind. Now the next or the fourth world corresponds very definitely with the Indian concept of kama or desire. This is the world in which emotion as yet not subordinated by reason, or emotion of its own nature and kind, thereby existing in its own world according to its own laws, and in these worlds and in these laws correct, but becoming involved in the larger composite pattern of all the worlds operating together, presents a rather complicated situation. And this world is therefore the world of desire, the world of illusion, the world of the bundle of attributes, the world of the stacks, as Buddha calls them, of faculty, actions, and reactions, and their effects upon man. In other words, this is the world of emotion, of possession, in the sense of emotion possession, of hate, of fear, of worry, of doubt, and of all things which are by their natures intense. And in this region we find enthroned ancient Hades, keeper of the Plutonian realm. He therefore signifies primarily the keeper of the ghosts of illusion, or as the medieval mystics and magicians called it, the sphere of the astral light. This is the garden of Klingsor in Parsifal, the garden that is brought into existence by enchantment, or the strange magic garden referred to by the French transcendentalist Eliphas Levy in his work on transcendental magic, in which he says it is a beautiful garden filled with wonderful flowers, each one with a deadly serpent twisted around its stem. This is the world of Mara of Buddhism, the world of the excess and the desire from which man must escape. Therefore, in the underworld of the Greeks, ghosts, shadows, are forever performing unnecessary and impossible tasks. Having no real subsistence and becoming the victims constantly of those excesses which they practiced on earth, as referred to or paralleled in the story of Dante's Inferno. These, of course, are the illusions, the ghosts, the shadows, by which most men live, causing Plato to say that men go to this abode not when they die, but when they are born. It is life controlled by illusion. And over this illusion sits a grave and ancient Hades, who is the keeper of this, and whose three-headed dog forever guards the gates of this infernal region. The ancient Greeks, however, did not regard this region primarily as one of punishment. They regarded it as one of hopelessness, or going on forever. Perhaps they had, perhaps some of them were psychologists and had clients. If they have, they would know what this hopelessness means. That you can work with an individual to help him get over a bad streak of selfishness for 10 years, to find in the end that he is just as selfish about the next thing he wants. Nothing seems to change, because it is not here that the change can be effected. Now this leaves us one more deity and one more sphere to accomplish, and that is body, which is the next lowest in this cycle of the ladder of worlds. Well, this ladder, as you can sense already, is very largely a psychological ladder, a ladder of factors. Now, the material world was to the ancients not a principle or an abode of principles, but a reservoir or receiver into itself of the principles of other things. Therefore, there is no karma or debt related to earth. All debt is paid in relationship to some other cause, and the drama is simply played out here. Thus, body is no cause of evil in itself. Man is not ever punished for being embodied. That is sufficient retribution in itself. Man is punished merely through the body, symbolically, for the things which he does to the body. And by doing them through his own body, to the bodies, lives, and natures of others around him. It is always the person in the body who is the carrier of responsibility, never the body itself. Therefore, strangely enough, the Greeks had a very beautiful thought about the body. They said that it belongs to matter. And that, wonderful and strange as it may seem, matter, which to us seems to be so rather disagreeable a thought, standing for materialism and all that thing, actually, matter is forever pure. Matter of itself can never be defiled. There is nothing cleaner than a good clean handful of good clean dirt. Matter in itself is never evil. It is never actually polluted by what anyone can do to it. Anything living in a material state pollutes only itself when it attempts to pollute matter. Matter is never polluted. Therefore, to the Greeks, matter was the world virgin, an eternal principle that is forever the victim of others, and yet regardless is never defiled. Because matter is wonderfully enough never soiled, but things living in it soil themselves and each other through their conduct. But when they depart and that body goes back to the earth again, it is pure again. It is the impurity of the person and not the body. For nature purifies everything, and in nature nothing that is corrupt is left. It must always be purified again. And so, it's not unreasonable that to this sphere they should assign their deity Hestia, whom we call Vesta. Vesta itself, suggesting not only purity, but also vestment, the body. And the body, therefore, is the eternal virgin, because of itself, it never defiles itself, because it is not a principle. It can never do evil, because it can never do anything. It is always the result of other things operating upon it that causing it to have innumerable appearances. Therefore, modestly draped in the ancient costume of the time, with the fold of her robe over her head, Vesta remains forever the verdant earth, beautiful, pure, beyond defilement. And those who would defile it defile themselves. This is a very interesting philosophical point if we want to study it. So here we have what we might term not only persons of a drama, but we have, like Faust, a play in five acts. Each of these acts taking place on one of these levels, under the sphere and body of one of these deities, whose very natures become the principles, energies, and worlds associated with them. Therefore, the material plane is Vesta. And within this material plane, man's material body becomes his vestment, or his garment, the robe which he throws over his shoulder and around his head, concealing always part of his own face, which is interesting because, as we know, the mask of the persona always hides part of itself. In this little drama, then, we have a wonderful set of stage settings. And in this set of stage settings, things begin to happen. And when these things begin to happen, we have a series of myths created in which all of these elements suddenly become not only embodied, but become strangely exaggerated, almost caricatures of their own temperaments. So out of these principles come persons with limitations of one kind or another, with restrictions upon themselves, with certain powers and certain weaknesses, with vision and insight in some matters and none in others. And we think of these as being merely drawn upon the mind of man by some ingenious artist of long ago. This is not essentially true. We are dealing with symbols which were used to conceal ideas of the deepest and most enduring importance. So we now go back to Zeus again, because we've set him up here behind the scenes, so to say, and given him a wonderful stage on which to operate. But we don't see very much operation as yet. We only see the worlds through which he is going to move and work, the certain deities with whom he is going to be related. And we must then come back and study Zeus himself. Now, Zeus is hard to study, because there is probably no deity in the Greek mythology who has more names, various titles, and a wider diffusion of actions on an innumerable group of planes than this so-called father of the gods and men. He is presented usually as a grave and massive person, bearing in his hands the thunderbolts, which are the peculiar symbols of his authority. He is therefore the thunderer. Anciently, he was the sky, and the thoughts that moved through his mind were the clouds. Whenever he rattled his thunderbolts, the earth shook. And his grave appearance reminds us also that in spite of his vast years and incalculable age, he is declared definitely never to have grayed, but to have had the blackest of hair and beard. This black hair and beard, of course, to the ancients was associated with the dark clouds of storm. And he hid himself also, of course, upon the great mountain of Olympus, where he remained in his own nature. But he did not stay there always. He came down the mountain into the various activities and associations with which his career has been identified. Now, we know that the mountain of Zeus is simply another name. Olympus is another name for the world's sacred mountains, wherever we may cross them or find them referred to. This mountain, of course, is the Kailasa of India, or the Simuru. This mountain, it rises above the earth. And, of course, this mountain is in itself a symbol of a region beyond creation.